Okay, we just finished talking about Dr. Debsky in the Bahamas.
All right.
Is that thing recording? I think it is. So she'll go over the syllabus and all the content that you're going to have in this course and what's required of you. I don't know all the details, so I'm not going to misinform you, all right? But basically she said if we could go over some introduction of the nervous system and kind of get you into the mood of what you might experience throughout this course. Some of you I know before, so we can harass like Burroughs and Schultz and Umang over there to answer questions, because you probably had this in Bio 350, a lot of the content that you get in this class too, in some of it, but then you're going to get more details because it's all focused on the nervous system. Has everybody already had Bio 350 in here? Anybody that didn't have Bio 350? Anybody didn't have Bio 350? So everybody, okay, a few people. So don't let us down in this course now. If you have Bio 350, you have to speak up about things that you learned, right? Because you've learned a lot in there about synaptic transmission. So let's go over some main kind of ideas and hopefully get you excited about neurobiology. And there's so much information every day coming out that you just can't even keep up with all the new findings that are happening in science. And has everybody kind of logged on to some kind of daily Science Daily or anything like that? You know? So if you're not, you should be. Science Daily. Just go up to Science Daily, and every day they'll send you some news articles that come out. And they're fascinating. I mean, they're just amazing. The latest things that are being published in all different fields, from planetary science to cell biology to new kinds of bacteria that they're discovering. And it's kind of neat. It keeps you going. And then you can click on it and get the original articles out of it. But that keeps you motivated about science and what you're studying and your major, right? And then you're informed when somebody says, oh, did you read that? Well, you're a biology major or a science major. And then you're going to say, no, I don't know what you're talking about. So you want to be up to date kind of and, keep motivated in what's going on. Well, in the nervous system, there is so much to talk about, right? You could have a whole major in the nervous system, neurobiology, which is coming down the line. And we do have a lot of neuro courses on campus that you might be interested in. And we'll go through some of that in a little bit. But let's think about the nervous system. What do you think about it when you hear the nervous system? Just the word nervous system. What comes into your mind? Particular animal? Or brain? Or what pops into your mind? Oh my gosh, too much to remember. No. Burroughs, I can pick on you.
Very interesting. Cool.
Very cool. Great. All right. And Umang will probably tell us.
When you said animal, I was thinking about like vivarians and how they have like great fats and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Yeah, definitely. And probably Schultz is thinking about a neuromuscular junction.
You probably want someone to bring up crayfish.
Of course, the crayfish. It's like the ultimate in understanding of the nervous system. Thanks. You got it. And then we'll get onto the fly. The fly's kind of interesting too, Drosophila. But when you think about this, think about on a comparative aspect, everything from a jellyfish, right, to us. So simple to complex. What do these simple to complex animals have to do in a nervous system with the nervous system? From jellyfish to us, what does a jellyfish have to respond to? The environment, right? A predator, right, might be touching it and it has to respond to it, but also it might respond in the sense of being aggressive, right? Releases those little nematocysts, right, that then can sting a predator. And what would happen to you if, your dog had rabies here and started to bite you, right? You're going to respond too, right? So you have to have some sense and an integration of that, and then you think about integrating it. Is it like a reflex, or is it a higher processing to then realize, oh, it's not, it's maybe playful biting, or is it really ferocious bite, So you have to process that. Higher animals can process that and kind of think, is that going to be a threatening stimuli and you have to do something about it, or do you just have is it a reflex, right? Like your patella, right? Everybody knows you hit your kneecap, right, and you kick the table out from the doc that's doing that on your knee, and you don't really have to think about that, right? You could have a complete transection in your spinal cord, and you're still going to have that kind of response, right? That's a reflex, monosynaptic, sensory, right to a motor nerve, and you have that response. Not really much higher processing. Anybody ever thought, could you think about it and try to stop that reflex? Have you ever thought about seeing if you could maybe inhibit that by just thought process? Do you think you could? I don't know, something to think about, right? And so, you know, how could you inhibit that kind of response? Maybe you could. All right. So if we think about this, you have some sensory input, right? Processing center. That jellyfish, do you think it has a really high processing center? Not much, right? These nerve nets, it was very confusing for a long time in neurobiology, the nerve nets in a jellyfish. If you touch on one side, you know a jellyfish, you know a mantle, right? And it beats, and it has to have a coordinated electrical activity to then contract those muscles so it can move, right? And if it didn't move right, then it wouldn't be able to get where it wanted to be. But it has to also, it responds to a stimuli. If you touch it on the side, it goes away from that stimuli. So somehow it has to know that that stimuli came from, say, the touch on one side, and it can respond and move away. But where's the processing for all that? And that has confused neurobiologists for many years to try to figure out, even in the simple nervous system, how that worked. And there's more being found even today. People are still working on simple nervous systems. And then you think about higher animals like us, processing center, that's really complex, right? And that's what you'll get into more in this course as well. But then you think about that motor output, and if it's going to a muscle, right, then that's usually a behavior that's elicited, right? So you could see those behaviors elicited, and then you know that it responded to the stimuli. But what's some examples out in the animal world that you might have heard of where you can't really tell that the animal responded? And when it gets a stimulus, or a threatening stimulus, for example. Anybody, anything pop to mind? If you were a sensory ecologist, for example, if you had your ecology classes, I think most of you probably did, is there some examples that they might have gone through that an animal doesn't respond so much that if you were watching it, you really couldn't tell if it was responding to a threatening stimuli? We need to get out more. Okay. Anybody go on a farm? Raise chickens? No one raises chickens here? Okay. We need a field trip. All right. So think about what happens with chickens. And it's a good example that people have. And other birds, too. If you had a chicken in the field, for example, and a cat's walking by, sometimes a chicken doesn't really respond to that cat right away or a predator. It will just keep pecking. And but if you could do what? You could probably measure the animal's heart rate. You'd probably see that animal, that chicken is responding, but it's not giving a behavioral cue to the predator. So then it can maybe back away or just play dead, you know, like an opossum, right, for example. So there's examples of animals modulating their behavior, even though they respond to the stimuli, but they don't want that predator to know that they're responding to that. Their presence, right? So you can think of that as higher processing to try to figure that out. So it's really quite neat to think about. And then you think about what's going on in these steps. And let's talk a little bit about that. So how do you excite sensory neurons? Just throw that out there. What type of senses do we have, first of all?
We have a tactile sense, we have pressure.
All right, so touch. Right, that's good. Anybody else? Pardon?
Proprioception.
Yes, like joint reception, proprioception. So internal receptors, more or less. Any other ideas?
Sensory.
Pardon?
Photoreceptors.
Photoreceptors, vision, right? What are our five senses? We're getting up to. Pardon?
Chemoreceptors.
Chemoreceptors, like taste. You could put that in taste and even in maybe olfaction, right? Because the chemicals bind to that. And something else?
Hearing,
right? Okay, so, you know, the five senses generally, but then you think about internal receptors, like Josh was just mentioning here, is that you have internal receptors. And we talked about proprioceptors, but what about other receptors internally? with some other internal receptors.
Thermoreceptors?
Yeah, thermoreceptors, right? Yeah, detect the temperature. But those can also be on the skin, but you also have them inside your brain to detect your body temperature, your set point, right? And then you have other receptors that detect osmolarity, right? Your osmolarity, your concentration in your body, in your fluids, and that can then stimulate, what, like antidiuretic hormone or aldosterone, you know, those that you remember from animal phys, right? So sensory reception for external and internal, really quite neat. And then you have to process that information. So how do you excite some of these different sensory receptors? Vision, right? We got that photoreceptor. You have to have that photoreceptor that picks up that wavelength of light, right? A particular wavelength, if you want to talk about red or blue or the rhodopsin, right? The molecules, so you can pick up different wavelengths of light. Auditory receptors, what kind are those? Any idea? Auditory, in your ear, inner ear.
Vibration.
That's right. The mechanoreception, basically. Remember that hair cell with the kinocilium that sticks up and the little stereocilia next to it, and if it bends towards the kinocilium or away from it, excitation, inhibition. So I'm just giving you kind of a review to get you into thinking about the nervous system input. So that's auditory, right, in your semicircular canals or even in your cochlea, that little snail-like structure, right? The fluid that moves from the vibration that you pick up in the air to your membrane, to your three little bones in your ear, then to another membrane, then that wave goes into fluid, and that fluid, endolymph and perilymph, then causes a mechanical movement of a membrane, that tectorial membrane, and then on that tectorial membrane are those hair cells, and it bends it, right? Either towards the kinocilium or away from the kinocilium. Is that ringing a bell? Everybody kind of get you refreshed again? All right, and for those that haven't had animal phys yet, you can look up a lot of these information. So auditory, but that's, you know, very similar to other types of mechanoreception as well. So what about touching the skin? If anybody had me for 350, it was like, you always remember, how do you transduce that mechanical stimuli into an electrical? What type of receptors?
Stretch.
So yeah, exactly. Stretch-activated ion channels, right? There's a protein inside of that membrane that when you deform that bilipid membrane, you deform it, right? And if there's a protein in there, you can deform it. You can open up that ion channel. So it's a stretch-activated ion channel. And then we think about, well, so what? We opened the channel. Or we, you know, put the hair cells towards the kinocilium. What is it that causes the cell to become excited? Let's just think about that for a minute. How do you have excitable cells? Excitable cells. Why are they excitable? Exactly. Resting membrane potential. So you have a resting membrane potential. Is it zero? No. It's some negative value usually, right? So where I'm going is that you have this potential, and it's not zero. The point is that you have an electrical potential, and that cell is waiting for some channel to open so ions can move down their potential. And remember, it's not just the electrical, it's chemical and electrical gradient, right? Sodium's higher on the outside than on the inside, right? So sodium wants to go down the concentration gradient into the cell. And if a cell is negative, it's going down its electrical gradient too, right? But what about potassium? Potassium's higher inside cells normally, right? And lower on the outside. So you open up a channel. Which way does potassium want to go? It's a plus ion. Let's say you're at rest. Does it want to go out? Well, yeah, out the concentration gradient. But where's the electrical gradient? If it's negative, then it wants to keep it in, right? So it's all the electrical excitability of cells depends on those gradients, electrical and chemical gradient, and where you are when that channel opens. So everybody knows the action potential, right? You had that 152 or 350. So if you opened up a potassium channel when you were at rest, are you going to get an action potential? Probably not, right? Because at rest, mostly, you're close to the E-potassium. Everybody remember that? Equilibrium potential for potassium. But as you opened up sodium channels and you depolarized and you came up, now if you open up potassium channels, what happens? now you can get a potassium flow, right? Because you're far away from the equilibrium for potassium. And if we're talking mystery terms here, then you might have to go back to your 350 textbook in time. But I think Dr. Dubsky will go through a lot of this again for you. Is that if you're high on the action potential, and now you open up potassium channels, now you have a driving gradient, right? So now you want the potassium, the equilibrium, you want to go back to the equilibrium potential for that ion. So that's everything about excitability of cells depends on your potential and the driving gradient of these ions. If you can't get the ions to move, there's no electrical excitability of the cells, right? So there's no excitation. So by having that potential there, generates this ability to be excitable, right? Like when you open up a stretch-activated ion channel. So if you have a abnormality, let's say your potassium concentration, your kidneys aren't working well, and your potassium levels rise, what happens to your nervous system? What happens to your heart, do you think? Right? Heart's electrical activity, right? Pacemaker cells. It doesn't work right, right? It's going to have arrhythmias. Your nervous system's not going to work right. So it's very important to have a very tight level, say, for potassium and some other ions as well. But potassium's really crucial. If you remember from your 350 lab, when you changed your solutions on a preparation, you saw the resting membrane potential depolarize, right? So that's important to kind of pull all that back together, refresh your memory about neurobiology, the neurophysiology in there, and I'm sure Dr. Debs is going to, you know, stepwise through it. I just kind of jumped to kind of get your brain jump-started a little bit. It's like an electroshock therapy for you. Okay. So how do we got the sensory cell excited, right? Now what do we do with it? So we got a sensory cell excited. Well, you have to respond to it somehow, right? It has to be integrated in the central nervous system. So if it's that nerve net of the jellyfish, you know, it's onto another cell, right? And that cell might be a motor neuron, so it can quickly respond. Or like your patella reflex, right? That was a monosynaptic sensory neuron right onto a motor neuron on your spinal cord, and you want to kick your leg out. But maybe you want some processing with that, too, to figure out what it is, right? So think about the electrical transduction from your sensory. You touched it. You opened up ion channels. What happened? Sodium went in. Maybe some potassium came out. You got an action potential. It's traveling up your arm. Where's the cell body for your sensory neurons on your skin? Common type of question if you're all or allied health, taking MCATs or PSATs or DSATs or any of those tests, right? Where's the cell body for your sensory neurons on your skin? Is it out here? Where is it? Not in the spinal cord. The cell body is on your dorsal root ganglion, right? Outside your spinal cord. And then those just sit right along their vertebrae. And then that's the cell body, dorsal root ganglion. And then that goes into the dorsal horn of your spinal cord, and then you integrate that information. All right. So there you have an action potential, and think about how it travels, right? All those properties that you remember, electrical conduction properties. I won't go into that right now, but that'll probably come along in the class as well. And then you think about that communication. Electrical or chemical, right? We don't have really too many electrical synapses in our brain. There are some. But you usually see those in what? Anybody remember? Where do you see electrical synapses? Well, in our heart, we have electrical conduction from cell to cell to cell. But I'm thinking about a nervous system, you know, a neuron to another neuron or a neuron to a muscle fiber. Anybody remember what kind of animals? Schultz had a good lead into it. Your favorite animal is? The crayfish. Got it. Okay. Oh, we're getting there. Get your brainwashed. All right. And the crayfish, for example, the tail flip, right? You touch the tail and it flips. Or in some cases, like if you're in the lab that's looking at fish, you can touch on the side of the tank and they quickly have a response, right? In some of those responses, they're so fast that people have recorded from neuron to the muscle cell, for example, and you could actually think, you know, about the amount of time it takes for synapses to work, chemical synapses, and you could actually predict how many synapses are in the circuit for that behavior. But when they were doing that, they actually found out some of those behaviors are so fast, the responses, that That doesn't make sense that it's really all biochemical. So in like the tail flip or escape responses, you usually see in the nervous system in animals electrical synapses somewhere in that circuit. For example, in the tail of a crayfish, you touch the tail on the back, it'll tail flip up very quick. And that sensory nerve goes to a interneuron. That interneuron travels up the ventral nerve cord, and then it has electrical synapses to a motor neuron, and that motor neuron onto the muscle fiber, releases transmitter, and causes the tail flip. That neural circuit and that behavior, if you had me for 350, you'll remember, that was the first neural circuit described to account for a behavior. And that was by Don Kennedy in the 1970s. And it became quite famous, he became quite famous, president of Stanford for a good while, because of the time of working out neural circuits to explain an animal's behavior. And he did it from cell to cell to cell. And he talked about, he described the type of synapses that occur from the sensory neuron to the interneuron to the motor neuron to the muscle fiber. So you see, that wasn't that long ago in the 1970s to really work out a whole circuit for an animal behavior. And then you think about, wow, that's just a simple little, you know, response, tail flip in the crayfish, and it took a good while to work it all out. Now think about the behaviors in our brain, higher thought processes, and how are we ever going to figure out how the nervous system, you know, works and all those synapses and all that communication. So it's kind of neat to think about. Let's think about a little bit of this. As we talked about gap junctions, you know, and they're hard to tweak. They're pretty much all or none, right? And what are those electrical, I should back up. These electrical synapses occur because of gap junctions, right? Proteins, and it's really amazing if you think about gap junctions. Both cells have to make the proteins, the subunits, and they have to come together and line up just right to make an ion channel. Isn't that bizarre? I mean, that's pretty neat to think about. They have to line up just right to make an ion channel, and they're selective. Some of them allow electrical conduction better one direction than the other direction. Isn't that weird? And people look at those and try to study what are the properties that allow those to be different. Those are called rectifying synapses. All right? Kind of hard to tweak. And then you have chemical synapses. It's like at your neuromuscular junction, right? Chemical synapse. What are some of the advantages then for a chemical synapse and what we were talking about so far? Right, so you could have a prolonged response, and the key there was receptors, right? Let's keep with that thought. What about receptors?
So you can also, like, prevent an actual potential from blocking out the next neuron.
So the point is here, you have different types of receptors. You have excitatory, inhibitory, and not only on the excitatory, you have different types of excitatory receptors, right? And when you think about just excitatory, you know, what kind of receptor are we thinking about? Well, there's lots of excitatory types of transmitters, right? Neurotransmitters. You have acetylcholine at your neuromuscular junctions, for example. You have glutamate high in your brain. And, you know, and then you think about GABA for an inhibitory. But even your acetylcholine receptors, acetylcholine as a transmitter, you have different types of acetylcholine receptors. And they respond differently. Some are ion channels. They open up as soon as acetylcholine binds to it and then allows ions to flow through that ion channel. That's like your neuromuscular junctions. That's the nicotinic receptors. And then there's the other type of acetylcholine receptors, like on your heart. They're not ion channels right away. They work. Acetylcholine binds to it. It works through a second messenger cascade, right? And then could work on opening or closing an ion channel. So the variety, the diversity of receptors gives you so much more plasticity or tweaking of the nervous system or modulating how it's going to function, right? And then you can think about what? Receptors, more receptors, fewer receptors changes how the synapse works, right? And that's important in what? Learning and memory, right? Or development of the nervous system. So these are all important factors that you think about. And you think, wow, that's really complex. And then you add up different types of neurotransmitters. And what if this target cell not only has excitatory, but inhibitory input onto it? And we shouldn't think of the transmitter as excitatory and inhibitory. We should think of the receptor, right? It's the receptor that makes it excitatory or inhibitory. For the most part, in our nervous system, glutamate is excitatory, GABA is inhibitory. But serotonin receptors, for example, there are serotonin receptors which are inhibitory to the cell. There are serotonin receptors which are excitatory to the cell. In us, there's probably about, generally, 14 or so serotonin receptors in your brain. But if you look at, if everybody took a drug here, you know, a serotonin agonist, you remember an agonist acts like the compound, an antagonist will block that receptor and block the transmitter's action. If everybody took the same agonist, serotonin agonist, at the same concentration for body weight, people would have all different kinds of responses here. Or if you took some antidepressant drug, for example, everybody would probably respond a little bit differently here. Why would you respond differently if even we took out your nervous system and put it in a dish, sliced it, and put serotonin on it? Why might there be differences in the response to that serotonin? And that's interesting to think about, you know, that. And so how do you treat people, right? Because they're going to respond differently. Because they found out that in some of these serotonin receptors, why there's differences, the protein, remember these are proteins, these receptors are proteins. And you remember from cell biology, when the protein's being made, what's one way to make it a little bit different? That doesn't relate to the DNA sequence? But you got the DNA sequence, you all probably have about the 14 different genes for these receptors, but why is the protein different and it's not the same for everybody? What's the term I'm looking for? I can read my mind. Pardon? Methylation, kind of. That could be part of it, but I'm thinking of something else that happens in the protein machinery as it's being made. Folded differently. What do we call that? Post-translational? Yeah. Post-translational modifications, right? And when you consider post-translational modifications, so it's not the gene, but how those proteins are modified by the time they're put in the membrane, they now think that we have about 54 in the humans, about 54 different types of serotonin receptors. Is that not amazing? That's amazing. And this is why people respond differently to different drugs for these. So you have to think about that. It's pretty complex. And we're just talking about serotonin receptors, right? Now you add in all the others and it's something else. I don't want to get off on my bandwagon too much. Okay. So let's think about these synapses. So here's a simple synapse. Can you see that from back there? Okay. Yeah. Kind of. Maybe. I'll send everybody this by email too. I got your email thing. I'll just pass it on to you. Okay. So you think about a presynaptic neuron, right? Postsynaptic cell. This could be a muscle cell or a neuron, right? And what do we think about for transmission? We think about these vesicles, right? Packaged with neurotransmitter. They fuse to the membrane, release their transmitter, goes across a synaptic cleft. This is terminology everybody should be kind of familiar with. Goes across a synaptic cleft, binds to receptors. In this case, it's showing you inotropic receptors, right? Inotropic receptors mean that it turns into an ion channel when the receptor binds to it. But tabotropic receptors will be shown different here. When it could bind and then trigger a second messenger cascade in the cell and then work on either opening or maybe closing an ion channel. So two types of receptors generally, inotropic or tabotropic. When you think about a receptor like glutamate, you could think about, oh, all right, what do we... When we talk about glutamate receptors, how do they get their names? They all respond to glutamate, but the receptors have different properties. They're different structures in the protein. They respond to glutamate, they might respond to different affinities, but you can separate out the types of glutamate receptors. Some are called NMDA, some are called AMPA receptors. Why do they give them those names? Because of the drugs that bind to those can activate them. Just like the acetylcholine receptors. We talked about the nicotinic ones on your skeletal muscles. We talked about muscarinic ones on your heart. The drug, nicotine, works on your nicotinic receptors. You don't make nicotine in your body. It's a pharmacological agent added onto it. And because it works on those receptors, they give them that name. And muscarin isn't naturally in your body, but they can take that out of plants and put it and give it to you. And then you have a response. So they give them those names based on the pharmacological nomenclature, just like this case. And you can right up there, but this is like an NMDA receptor. This is an AMPA receptor. This is a kainate receptor. Why are they given the names? They're all glutamate receptors, but they respond differently. They'll even bind glutamate at different affinities, but they have different properties. The AMPA receptor, for example, opens up and allows sodium to go in to the cell and depolarize and excite the cell. The NMDA receptor, and I'm sure Dr. Debsky will talk more about this in detail because there's a lot more about this particular type of receptor. I mean, glutamate binds to it, and some other things have to happen before it can open up. But basically, it opens up and becomes an ion channel, and not only does it allow sodium to go in, but calcium to go in. And so that's different than the AMPA receptor, right? When that calcium goes in the cell, calcium is like that magic, right? It can do so many things once it's in the cell. It can trigger second messenger cascades. It can trigger even more calcium release from internal stores inside the cell. So it can amplify that response. And if you get too much calcium in, it can actually cause the cell to be damaged. So it's kind of interesting to think about. They're all glutamate receptors, but they can have different functions on that cell. And it's interesting, as Dr. Debsky will probably give you some primary papers, some of these receptors can come out of the membrane and sit right below it, and then, depending on the activity, can actually be inserted in the membrane. Wow, that means it can change its sensitivity to glutamate, right? And this is part of the principles behind long-term potentiation, where you can have extra excitation over time from activity, or depression. It's not a lack of vesicles or transmitter, it's a lack of receptors, where receptors can actually internalize, and then the cell's not so responsive to glutamate anymore. So think about that plasticity just with glutamate receptors, and then you think about the different types, and then you think about the density of receptors. If this cell had many AMPA receptors, and only a few of those, and another cell had few AMPA receptors, and a lot of these, you're going to get different responses in the cell, right? With the same amount of glutamate that's released. So the variety that all those perturbations make it very interesting for neurophysiologists to study. They make it interesting to think about what happens in learning or changes or high excitability in the nervous system. It's now been shown even with one grand mal seizure, for example, an epileptic seizure, changes the plasticity of the nervous system permanently. And that's been pretty interesting. People didn't think it had such an effect, but they've been able to show this now. And so there's, you know, that high excitability one time that they can actually have some permanent changes in synaptic structure. Wow, that's amazing, right? So very important now, they realize it's very important to treat these seizures early on and not to have them so many because they can really cause problems. So it's very interesting to think about all this ability. And then you have in our brain, you know, glial cells, supportive cells. And so much more information is coming out about the glial cells. It used to be just thought, well, that was the glue of the nervous system. But you have more glial cells in your brain than you do neurons, actually. So that's kind of interesting. You know, what do they do? And a lot of more information is being discovered all the time about glial cells' function. It's becoming much more of a hot topic. So people are beginning to really do a lot of research on these glial cells. For one thing, we know that it can take up transmitter, like glutamate, for example. It converts it to glutamine, so glutamine, and then that glutamine can go out of the glial cell and go back out into the extracellular fluid, and that neuron can take it back up and then reprocess it and repackage it. So it's very important, right, for the recycling of the neurotransmitter. It's also known that if a cell is excited, right, action potential is coming down, boom, 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 what happens when an action potential comes along the neuron? Sodium goes in. What comes out? Potassium, right? Potassium. But we just talked about potassium being bad if you raise it up around cells, right? So how do you get that potassium away from that cell if it's coming out? Glial cells can take out potassium quite quickly. But also, how does your cell reset itself from action potentials?
Sodium potassium
pump, right? And it's probably the most energy-demanding process, as I mentioned, 350 several times, probably the most energy-demanding process in your body at rest is maintaining sodium-potassium pump, the ATP that it takes to keep that pump working, right? Because of that, you don't want those ions to be imbalanced. So for your heart, for your nervous system. They're always working, right? And if you just think about a million neurons in your eye, right, and you're looking out at something, you're activating those, that's a lot of movement of ions along that whole neuron, and you got to reset all that, those back again. And it's all by ATP-dependent processes, the sodium-potassium pump. So very important to think about putting that energy demand to it as well. Okay, so this figure you can't really see, but I made copies for people. I don't know if I made enough, but I'll send you the link too. Let's pass this around. And some of you could probably share it. I'll give you this. This just kind of came out to kind of give us an interesting overview of synapses. And you think about this, and it's quite amazing. So let's think about what happens here. And if you look at those pictures as it's circulating, let's see what time is it. Do I have enough time to play? We get out of here at 1:45? Yes. 45, another 45 minutes. Okay. Let's have some fun. I like to have fun. You don't like to have fun. So, why don't we... Oops, somebody had fun with drawing people. Okay. These are little whiteboards. And we're going to have interaction. Forced interaction. So what we can do is to get together with a person or two, and I'll pass these around. How about you two get together? And how about you two?
Great.
You two. Oh, you need some over there, don't you? Do you need some for? So what we want to think about, if you can talk to each other, right, is what would be the scroll of synapse. Is that going to work for you, everyone?
Let's see.
Kind of, maybe, maybe not. Here we go. So let's draw a synapse. Presynaptic, postsynaptic, like a little bulb on the presynaptic nerve terminal. Well, you got one together. Okay, you need one. All right. I know. And interact together or talk. So think about drawing like this nerve terminal up here. A little bit. Just the main big picture. All right. Chana, I don't see any drawings on this. Come on. Just that kind of a big thing. And what we want to think about is think about how this nerve terminal gets excited. All right? So I want you to kind of draw the big picture and, like, okay, you got an action potential coming down the nerve terminal. So you can draw an action potential on the side. Boom. Right? What happens after the action potential comes down the nerve terminal? What allows this whole process to go on? Let's see about how creative you might be. Or how much you remember from things. So you got that nerve terminal, and you see this process, all this stuff going on. What triggers this to start working? And then what's meant here by, you know, this process going on? What makes this go here and then become a fusion pore and all that kind of good stuff? Just kind of what you think about. And it could be imaginary. Be creative. Right? Little elves are in there or something if you want to.
Forming baseball. and then the Asian bouncing to this membrane, and then the open, like release of transmitter in here, and then this part possible will be recycled to the end.
And you might look at that figure, or you might just go with what you have. Just kind of some general ideas. What happens after that action potential comes down the nerve terminal? What do we remember? This looks good. Good drawings around. Let's think about maybe getting some input from some of your fellow colleagues. I forgot your name with the red hat.
Kai.
Do you want to try to come up and kind of draw on the board a little bit what you have? It looks good. And then we can all talk about it as class. And then we'll see what we might want to add or take away. Or be careful, the dog here sleeping. It's okay.
When you reach threshold.
Yeah, visual.
Okay. Yeah. All right, so he's going to give a bit of explanation what they came up with in their team. We'll call them the red team. They're both wearing red shirts and red clothes over there. Got the red team. I don't know about the Cardinals colors, but anyways.
Chicago.
Okay. Chicago. So we have this is presynaptic neuron?
Presynaptic, postsynaptic. You're going to get some PTSPs. Propagate an action potential.
Well, that's a good point. So you could just draw some proteins in there if you want to. So he mentioned something about snare and snap proteins.
I forget which one. Then once some calcium comes in to initiate this binding, then it releases the neurotransmitters into the cleft here. Then these can go. Bind right onto the receptors, and they can either go back up into the cell that way, or get broken down as a BCDHGs. It's missing the whole mysteries.
So either uptaken or something broken down by enzymes.
That's all we can.
Okay, and that's good. Yes. Yes. So what would? So what are we? Kyle, right?
Kai
has a neat drawing here. The action potential coming down And the key part here is calcium coming in. How does this calcium come into the cell? What type of channels are those?
Voltage-gated
calcium channels. So the action potential has to be high enough to open up the action, the voltage-gated calcium channels. And maybe Kyle's doing it. So let's think about this. What you got? I want to make sure I got what you're saying right. So these voltage-gated calcium channels open up, and then calcium comes in, and then he mentioned that it plays a role here on the vesicle process. So how does calcium, how does this magical process of calcium cause the vesicle to fuse? Anybody have that on their drawing or something that they thought about?
Is it bind to like synaptoglycan or proteins like that changes their conformation, allows it to bind to the part of the membrane?
Exactly. So there's, as Kai has written down here, vesicles can be up in the presynaptic nerve terminal. Some can be docked, already docked, ready to go. And it just takes this bit of calcium to come in. And it's thought, like what you were referring to here, is that there's a break. There's this protein that's on the vesicle. The idea is that this protein on the vesicle is inhibiting it from fusing. It's like a break, right? But when calcium binds to it, it changes its conformation and releases the break. And now the vesicle can fuse into the membrane. And that protein is referred to as synaptotagmin. And there's four binding domains of calcium on it. And people have actually studied how calcium binds to it. And it's been thought that if you bind one calcium, the next calcium can potentiate and enhance the response. It's kind of like that hemoglobin oxygen dissociation curve. So that's kind of neat to think about. And then, but you have to have these vesicles docked. So how do vesicles get from here to here? All right? How do vesicles heal? And then that whole recycling. Microtubules might bring it right on down. And then there might be a special region here called the synapse, right, where they will enhance their docking spot. So there has to be some kind of drive for them to go right there, right? So usually when you think of a synapse in an electron microscopy figure, it's wide, it's thick here for the synapse because there's a lot of proteins in that region. And those proteins then can bind with the proteins on the vesicle, like you were saying, snares and snaps. These proteins interact and hold it there, docking it there. Some idea about these vesicles coming off of the cytoskeleton. Do you remember the Nobel Prize that was awarded a few years back? Paul Greengard. Anybody remember that? Paul Greengard. He did a lot of his work in squid axons. And he found that the protein called synapsin, that holds the vesicle here, when it's phosphorylated, a phosphorylation, then the vesicle comes off the cytoskeleton, and then it can be released and then can be docked. And he discovered a lot of that work in the squid axon. So these invertebrate preparations are very important to understand some of these processes. Now, what you just mentioned about the docking process here, the synaptotagmin and the snare hypothesis, who won the Nobel Prize a few years back? Anybody remember? What was last year's Nobel Prize? Physiology and medicine. Biologist. We're studying this field. We've got to keep these kind of things in your mind. So you should look up.
First three of them.
Lou Rothman shared this as well as. Thomas Sudhoff and the other fellow, which I'm now, I have an excuse because I'm over 50. So, Flaxman. But there, Lou Rothman, he came up with the snare hypothesis. Wally Whitehart, right over here in our biochemistry department in UK, he actually worked under Lou Rothman in many of these discoveries that he made before. And Wally Whitehart, Sydney, he works with mast cells because it's the same process of a mast cell. Inside of that mast cell, the fusion to release like histamine and other chemicals. It's that same kind of process. It's a big cell you can work with. So, and Sudhoff was the one that did a lot with synaptotagmin and worked about synaptotagmin. So they got the Nobel Prize because this is so important. Why? It's everything from a jellyfish to a human, right? It's the fundamental principles of vesicle fusion. And some of those proteins are similar even in yeast, how in yeast the vesicle fuses to the membrane. It's phenomenal. So very important process. So this process of docking and then responding to calcium, like you mentioned, is really key. And then in some cases, it could be an exocytosis, a complete like that. In other cases, it's thought that it might make a little fusion pore, like that, also called a lollipop. And some of this terminology is kind of changing over the times, but, you know, it looks like a lollipop, right? Big old lollipop. Or kiss and run, because the vesicle kisses, fuses, and then runs away. And then, like you were drawing or referring to, is that vesicle then can be recycled, repackaged by the transmitter that comes back in, or maybe from the cell, right? And then that process all occurs again. Binding across the synaptic cleft, this is where you were referring to as an enzyme. And what was that enzyme?
Acetylcholinesterase,
right? And that's going to happen at acetylcholinesterase enzyme, right? Breaks down acetylcholine. But what does it do? So it breaks down, this is what happens at your neuromuscular junctions. So acetylcholine breaks down, part of that acetylcholine molecule comes back into your nerve terminal. Do you remember what part? Acetyl or the choline? Choline part. So the choline comes back into the nerve terminal, so only part of the whole molecule comes back in the nerve terminal, gets resynthesized into acetylcholine, and can get put back into the vesicle. Now, as he just mentioned, there are these transporters to transport the molecule back in, but then how do you get it back in the vesicle? Again, a different type of transporter. These are vesicle transporters. They have different structure than the transporters on the membrane. So that's kind of amazing too, right? And they're very fast. They're very efficient. This acetylcholinesterase that I mentioned here is really quite neat. And so when you think about all those complexities, it's just cool. Where does it come from? At your neuromuscular junctions, at your skeletal neuromuscular junctions. Where does this acetylcholinesterase come from? Some of this is kind of more recent information, but it's neat. Is it just made by some supporting cells, or what, how does it get there? And is it important? If they took it away, would it matter? What do you think would happen if you took away acetylcholinesterase? You wouldn't be able to move. That's exactly right. So you might stiffen up at first, and we'll get into that. But then what might happen over time? You die, exactly. And so that's a good point. And this is really important, because many of your insecticides that kids die every year from is that these insecticides inhibit acetylcholinesterase. And there's many children that die from this, or even farmers that might get overexposed to this insecticides, or plant workers in factories that work with this stuff too. But it's also nerve gas agents. Some of the nerve gas agents work on acetylcholinesterase, so it's important to understand it for biological warfare and actually treatment as well, right? So acetylcholinesterase, this enzyme, can be secreted from the muscle cell, like in your muscles, and it can be released from the nerve, the motor nerve terminal too, from both cells. And it ends up in this synaptic cleft, in this matrix that's here. It's not just free space, there's actually a matrix that's between here. And that acetylcholinesterase is the enzymes on there. So what happens, and you mentioned a good point, if you took that away, or you took a nerve gas agent, or used insecticide, which is basically like a nerve gas agent, and you inhibited that, then what happens when you excite the cell? You have a lot of acetylcholine. And like you mentioned, then it might cause a lot of contraction at first, right, the muscle. But then all of a sudden, what happens is you become flaccid. And you can't, and you want to move your muscles, but you can't. You're just like, ugh. So what's happening? Acetylcholine's there, why aren't the muscles excited?
Downregulation of receptors.
Kind of. It's another word for that I'm looking for. They don't really internalize and downregulate or change their synthesis that quick. This is pretty fast. That can happen.
Desensitization.
So as acetylcholine binds to this receptor, and remember, your nicotinic receptors on your muscle, their ion channel opens up, sodium goes in, potassium goes out, excites your muscle cell. But think of that receptor as a protein here. It's closed. Acetylcholine binds to it. It opens, allows the ions to flow. But then it continues to change its conformation as acetylcholine is still bound to it. And this is a desensitized state. It's not open anymore, but acetylcholine is still bound to it. Now you take away acetylcholine by the enzyme and chew it up, and it comes off, right, and it gets chewed up, it takes some time for that protein to re-get back into its conformation so it can be excited again. And that inactive state is a desensitized state. So it's not gone from the membrane, but it's desensitized. So if you desensitized, you excited it, but then you're in a desensitized state because the acetylcholine is still here, what happens? You can't. It doesn't matter that you released more acetylcholine, right? You can't activate them because they're desensitized. It's going to take some time for that acetylcholine to get away and then go back to basically a resting state as well so that the molecule can get back into its regular shape. So what do you use if you've got an insecticide that blocks acetylcholinesterase or a nerve gas agent that you've been exposed to? How do you save this person from respiratory failure? What's the first line of treatment? Or what would you think of academically to do here to take away that desensitization? Add ACHE if you could, but it might be hard to get it in the body, but that's a good point. You know, get that in there so maybe you can flush it out. But, you know, we're down in the neuromuscular junctions and stuff. But they give another drug, atropine. And atropine competes, it blocks that, and it takes up, it competes for the acetylcholine on the nerve, on the receptor, and takes away the acetylcholine, but it doesn't cause it to be in a desensitized state. So atropine can be given to then bind to those receptors and make acetylcholine go off, and then slowly it's taken away from the synapses, and it can be reactivated again. But what if you gave atropine and you didn't have that as the problem? Then you could also have problems, right? Because now you've bound this to the receptor and your acetylcholine can't bind. Trade-off, you know, what's going on, right? Basically, you put someone on a ventilator and breathe for them until they get it out of their body and they can function again. That's kind of the main key. So that was very good. These transporters are really important, right? Because, as you know, if you could block these transporters, like what is the case for serotonin, when we talk about serotonin synapses, what's a medication that's referred to that works in the serotonergic nervous system? SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs. Supposedly they block this, and then you're going to have more serotonin in the synaptic cleft, right? Now, it depends. Some people respond differently to that, you know, and everybody's a little bit different. They actually realize that these transporters, like you drew here, are also vary depending on race and, again, post-translational modifications. For example, they now know that some Asians do not respond well to SSRIs because their uptake protein is a little bit different. It doesn't bind at the same level. So you have to give them a higher level of SSRI to have the effect. But if you give somebody more higher level of it, what else are you subjected to in pharmacologically terms? Side effects. Right? So now you might have more side effects, and I'm not working on that system particularly, but other effects. So this is really interesting to put it all together. Thank you. And I noticed good drawings from everybody. That's really good. All right, so if we keep thinking about some of this, I just wanted to really get you going. And that was a good drawing that you had up there. Okay. So if we think about what we've just been talking about, you think about modulation of the synapse, feedback mechanisms, autoreceptors, right, back on the nerve terminal. You can even have the same type of receptor from the transmitter you just released back on the same presynaptic nerve terminal, and those are autoreceptors. So you have these on your motor nerve terminals, as well on your, sorry, in your spinal cord on activating cells. But you can also then have these in your central nervous system and higher centers for all different types of receptors, like serotonin receptors. There are some that are more in the category of feedback receptors. So these autoreceptors. What about this repackaging of the transmitter? You know, that's really important, right? What we just talked about. If you were inhibiting the reuptake, right, and you kind of depleted or didn't have enough of that neurotransmitter around to repackage. There are drugs that can inhibit that, as we talked about, like SSRIs for serotonin. Depression, you know, what is synaptic depression? I don't mean a psychological depression. I mean like synaptic depression. What could happen if you, you know, you keep working, right? You're exercising, you're running the marathon, and I'm just too tired, I can't run anymore. And your muscles, you feel like you can't fire them anymore. Are your muscles totally depressed? I mean, could you contract your muscles if you put an electrode on them and you stimulated them? You could probably still get muscle contraction. So it's not the muscles failing, probably. It's probably more or less some of it, fatigue, and that kind of idea of a whole animal not wanting to keep responding. That's a psychological factor somewhat as well. Because think about, you're tired, you're not running anymore, but your, you know, friend's next to you and saying, go, 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 and all of a sudden you get some more energy and keep going, right? So fatigue somewhat, if you talk about just fatigue, that has a psychological component to it. So you want to take away from that when you're looking at a model preparation. So what do? You take it out, like in your mouse prep or your frog prep or your best prep, crayfish prep, and you take it into the dish, right? You have a muscle and you have a nerve and you repetitively stimulate. And you find out, can it keep up the force or not? Does it start to weaken? It doesn't generate as much force if it's a nerve muscle prep. Why? If you stimulate the muscle directly with an electrode, can you still get force? Maybe you could, right? If you could, then you know it's not the muscle. Maybe it's the nerve terminal. Maybe you're stimulating it so much you don't have time for repackaging. Maybe you're running out of ATP, because something we didn't mention, that vesicle fusion and reuptake, pinching back off to recycle, is ATP dependent. So that the proteins that allow that fusion pore to make is ATP dependent. The pinching back off is ATP dependent. So where's your ATP come from? Mitochondria, right? So if that can't keep up, that could be a problem for synaptic depression. It could be a presynaptic phenomenon. So that's what's meant in that part. Facilitation or enhancement of synaptic transmission. We thought of lots of things already, right? Put more receptors in the membrane. You could enhance the response. You could enhance a second messenger cascade inside the cell, right? If you're activating a second messenger, you could enhance something and get a greater response. What Dr. Debsky will probably talk about with facilitation too is a term called long-term potentiation, which can occur for minutes and hours later. And the idea behind that, a lot of it was described in the hippocampus in mice brains, is that more receptors, more of those AMPA receptors are put into the membrane and it responds more to it over time because of the activity that the system had. There's also, in that same kind of synapse, the hippocampus has NMDA and AMPA receptors. When you take away the AMPA receptors, you can get synaptic depression. So there it's a postsynaptic phenomenon, right? But you can also get facilitation in another way. Anybody remember? In a presynaptic way. Okay. What did we just talk about here that Kai just responded to? An action potential coming down. What comes in? Calcium. What happens to this calcium that after it's in the nerve terminal? Why doesn't it just keep causing vesicles to keep releasing, right? Keep
using.
That's right. Some of that calcium is taken up into a mitochondria. Some of that calcium is actually pumped out. It's pumped with an ATP-dependent process. Oops, I can't write. ATP. So there's pumps in the membrane. There are also exchangers in the membrane that allow calcium to come out and sodium to go in, called the sodium-calcium exchanger. There are also many calcium-binding proteins inside the nerve terminal, so they can bind up calcium. But they can't keep binding up calcium all the time, right? Otherwise, it would be saturated. So when the cell's not active, the calcium can come off those proteins as a slow KD, dissociation constant. The calcium comes off and then can be pumped out or exchanged out. But what would happen if you had an action potential, calcium came in, builds up, and then all of a sudden you gave another stimulus right after that one? The calcium hasn't had time to come back down yet, and now you stimulate it again, so calcium builds up again, right? So you're going to get a gradual rise of calcium inside the nerve terminal from stimulating. So if you could record in this target cell, if you stimulated one time, boom, you get a response. Let's say it's this excitatory, and you open up glutamate receptors. And then you stimulate maybe again, you get that response. All right? But if you stimulate rapidly, then you can get this, 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 and you get a much larger response with repetitive stimulation. And this was first described by Bernard Katz in the 1950s. And he described this in the frog neuromuscular junction, sub-threshold, so you're not generating action potentials in the muscle fiber. And he kept this below the threshold. And he also worked in the crayfish preparation. And showed that, so it's not getting an action potential in the muscle fiber, but it's enhancing, and it's actually bigger here than it was here. So it's not just additive. This is facilitation, more than additive, all right? So what's happening here, Bernard Katz described this in the 1950s, is calcium, residual calcium. As calcium comes in, it can't come out fast enough. Another action potential, calcium builds up more. What does that more calcium do? Causes more vesicles to fuse. Calcium builds up even more, more vesicles this time. And so you get more and more transmission being released with repetitive stimulation, and then you can excite more of these glutamate receptors. And at your crayfish insect neuromuscular junctions, most of those neuromuscular junctions use glutamate as a neurotransmitter. At vertebrate neuromuscular junctions, skeletal, acetylcholine. So this was described back in the 50s, and this is related to facilitation. In that sense, this is kind of like synaptic memory, right? Because it knows what happened before. Depending on what happened before, it changes the response later. So this is why it was big news in that time when it came out in the 1950s, because it was beginning to understand a form of, you know, like having a memory of what happened before to it. Then if you wait for a long period of time, let's say this is now a hippocampal slice in a rat brain, and Dr. Debsky will talk more about these studies. If you wait some time, let's say minutes, I've got some time, and you gave a single stimulus, and you got a bigger response than that first stimulus, that's wild. You waited minutes here, and the calcium's back down, but you got a bigger response with this single stimulus than you did with the single stimulus in the beginning. And this is what's referred to as long-term facilitation, or LTF, or LTP, long-term potentiation. This quick response right here is referred to as short-term facilitation, STF. STF is more thought to be due to residual calcium. Long-term potentiation in the brain, like in the hippocampus, this is what took many years for people to come together to figure out what was happening. And the main idea is that these AMPA receptors insert into the membrane with a high-frequency stimulation, and now you're more sensitive. And so when you stimulate later with the same amount of transmitter, you have more receptors, so you get a bigger response. All right? So this is kind of that idea behind that. And she'll probably go into some more papers, primary papers, about that description in time. All right. So we talked about acetylcholine, transmitter facilitation. Oh, so I wanted to kind of end off with some fun things to make you think about. And that is some, and you can Google this, you know, just put some things up there. Let's talk about diseases with the nervous system and ideas of synaptic transmission. Think about all these proteins. Wow, right? Proteins for the vesicle to dock. What happens if you didn't have synaptic syntaxin, for example? Now, if you didn't make synaptotagmin as an infant and you're growing and your brain's developing, remember your brain develops very early on. Or let's say your calcium channels don't work. You had a mutation somewhere in the DNA and the calcium channels aren't being made. What do you think is going to happen to that fetus that's developing? Ideas? Is it going to develop right, do you think? Maybe the heart won't even develop right, right? And the cells won't develop right. And the nervous system's not developing right. So what's going to happen to it? Probably die, right? And this is what's generally the case. There's lots of spontaneous abortions. There's nothing mysterious about it. But people are trying to save the samples and find out why. And the studies have been out, and I think it was a Vanderbilt study, where actually people trying to get pregnant and their pregnancies and know that you're fertilized, and you know, you check the birth, little blue X, right, and all that kind of good stuff. You know, you're pregnant. But about 60% of fertilizations have spontaneous abortions. So why is it so high? And if it's, you know, that's something to think about too. About 60% of all fertilizations end up in spontaneous abortions. Why? Is it ion channels? What's the reason behind it? Right? And so you think about that and you think, oh, it's, you know, there's reasons behind it. So people are trying to study out why that is. And maybe there's, you know, genetic mutations that are transmitted on in the family, or other reasons too. So it's kind of interesting to think about. But how about us right now? You know, if you started to get a muscle weakness and you're tripping all the time, you know, what is it? Is it a tumor in your brain? Is it something in your muscles? And sometimes that's what causes a person to go into the doc and say, hey, you know, I'm tripping. I just don't feel right. You know, what's going on? So they do tests on you. Find out if it's a tumor or something else, right? Or your nervous system's compressed. Maybe you got a spinal compression or something, right? Or it could be something else, like what's shown up here. It could be a neuromuscular disorder. It could be myasthenia gravis. It could be Eaton-Lambert syndrome, where you make antibodies against your own acetylcholine receptors. Is that not bizarre? Make antibodies against your acetylcholine receptors. In many forms of cancer, you make antibodies to particular proteins in your body. It's very weird. And so they didn't say, oh, they can test for the antibody. And they say, oh, you've got, you know, lung cancer probably. Because many lung cancers can produce antibodies to your acetylcholine receptors. So they try to find out where the tumor is, and sometimes it's just a small little tumor. They can find it, remove it, and all of a sudden you're better. You quit making antibodies to your own acetylcholine receptors. Is that not bizarre? That's bizarre, right? There's lots of different disorders like this. Has anybody read the book? And I swear you need to get it. If I had enough money, I'd buy everybody the book. Brain on Fire. Who's read Brain on Fire? Nobody's read Brain on Fire? It's like required reading. It's so good. Brain on Fire. You should order it today. Go to Amazon and order it today. And you will be up. I got the book. My daughter told me about it. She's in PT school. And she said some of the case, she was doing a rotation up by Cincinnati, and they were talking about it with this person that they were taking care of. And I said, I never heard about it. And so she got it. And she said, would you buy it for him, Christmas present? I said, yeah, okay. So we got it. And then, of course, I took it away from her and read it. But that night, I started reading it. I couldn't put it down. 1 o'clock in the morning. Oh, finally, I finished this book. It was so good. Once you start reading it, Brain on Fire. I'll give away part of it. They should make a movie out of it. But this person had a lot of different problems. And what did they have? They were making antibodies to their NMDA receptors, to their subtype of glutamate receptors. Bizarre, right? She happened to have a form of anti-NMDA antibodies, which was not due to a cancer. And they, you know, some of these people have this problem, and others that it's from a cancer. And then I thought, well, that is just so neat. And I know about Eaton-Lambert syndrome, but you know, what about all the other proteins? So I got on PubMed really fast. You know, now it's about 2 o'clock in the morning because I'm all excited. I said, well, if they had NMDA, then they must have AMPA. I didn't find anybody with an AMPA antibodies, you know. But then I started reading a little bit more, and I heard about this stiff man syndrome before, but I didn't know the mechanisms behind it. I thought it was hyperexcitation of motor nerves. But it's actually antibodies against GABA receptors, inhibitory receptors in your brain, and it causes you to stiff man syndrome. Because why? You're overexcited because you're not having the inhibition. Is that not cool? That is so cool. So you think about all those proteins and the misdiagnosis that went on for years. This book came out, and the University of Pennsylvania doc works on this, but when they published this lady that had this disease, she was a newspaper writer. And then she wrote a book about it, this book, and she wrote newspaper articles in the New York Times. Then other people started thinking, well, I have these symptoms. And then they started to find out, oh, many other people have the same problem. Then they started to screen for the antibodies, and they described many people with anti-NMDA receptors. How many people ended up in the funny farm when you finished reading this or died without ever knowing the cause? And now people are beginning to find that out. All right, one other thing I want you to think about, and that is think about courses. And this is a great time to do it. This is a Cold Spring Harbor course, and it's on your PowerPoint that I'll send to you. And you can just look, just Google summer courses, neuroscience, if you want, if you're interested in neuroscience, for example. We had undergraduates in the lab that went to Spain. She took Spanish course and a sensory neuroscience course that was taught out of University of Connecticut in conjunction with a group in Spain. Now, they are a little pricey, some of the especially overseas courses, but she knocked out a couple courses in a summer and got credit. You have to work through your advisors here and make sure you get credit. But these courses, like this one, is right here at Cold Spring Harbor. We've had undergraduates in graduate students go to college for Harvard, take neurobiology of the Drosophila, genetics of Drosophila. They love it. And we had some people go to Friday Harvard in Washington to take courses. And some of them are invertebrate neuroscience course. It might be advanced genetics. Some of the times, they give you the fellowship. All you have to do is get there. And then there's people that have donated money to these institutions to pay for the students' housing and food. So you apply for the fellowships, you apply for the course. These courses are internationally competitive, so you know, really put your best effort forward. If you help them writing letters or anything like that, glad to look after your application. But these are the kind of things to get you out. And get brought. Here's a course on ion channels and synaptic transmission. Wow, a whole course with leaders in the field. These guys are world famous. And they're really good. Okay, so let's stop there. And Debski should be back on Thursday and probably continue. All right. Have a good one. Hope you got you excited about neuroscience.